Hello, I'm Mike Cohen. This is number 0548, The Stuff File, program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0548. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Stan Goldman, author of Left to the Mercy of a Rude Stream, which talks about how his mother avoided death not once, but twice, while in Nazi death camps.
They needed slave labor to work in a factory in Berlin. So my mother spent much of the latter part of the war being, bombed by the Allies in a Berlin factory is working. And at the end, she gets shipped for execution to one of the places that basically replaced Auschwitz. And my mother's in Ravensbrück, probably about to be killed. One day, out of nowhere, some buses arrive and mysteriously take her after a somewhat hazardous four-day journey in which she's being bombed by the Allies again, who think they're German trucks. They arrive in Sweden.
Miranda Oh, author of the romantic chick-lit series Chin Up, Tits Out. The title came from a sort of mantra that her mother would tell her as a child.
My mom and I had this kind of daily routine where we would stand up straight and strike a pose and tell each other that we're beautiful. And then as we got older and experienced new things and get stressed or get into a situation where you're not really confident, it was hold your chin up high, shoulders back, stand up tall, stand up straight. Just those little coaching tools to our physical body that made us feel more confident in time, but also it made us look more confident outwards. And it's kind of like that fake it till you make it, but I grew up with chin up, tits out.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0548, was Michael Cohen, who is in charge of PR for the English Montreal School Board. He's also a columnist in the Montreal Suburban and a city councillor for Côte Saint-Luc. Thank you very much, Mike, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? An unnamed 47-year-old Italian woman convicted of fraud in 2017 in Sicily has been on the run since then, eluding authorities by hiding in convents. The woman moved to the northern regions of Italy and phoned convents pretending to be a sister looking for help and claiming she was severely ill. As she moved from convent to convent, she changed her identity, duping nuns who trusted her and thought her to be kind. Finally, a Benedictine nun grew suspicious and phoned police, telling them her stories were full of contradictions. Nuns use long words like contradictions. Non-nuns use much shorter terms. Authorities verified her identity and arrested her. She now faces further charges of claiming false identity. Yes. For a while, she was getting away with the immaculate deception. Her actions were habit-forming. Perhaps she will need a 12-step program like Bride of Christ Anonymous. 63-year-old Juan Zamora of Kissimmee, Florida, needed directions on February 8th and flashed his headlights at a Marion County Sheriff's squad car to ask for help. Deputy Calvin Batts obliged, but during the conversation, he noticed Zamora smelled like alcohol and was unsteady on his feet. Zamora then resisted Batts' request to take a breath test, saying, "You didn't pull me over. I pulled you over," and told the officer he is legally disabled, which would account for his instability. However, it wouldn't explain the bag of white powder found in Zamora's shirt pocket, which field tested positive for cocaine. Batts also reported finding a 2/3 full bottle of Canadian whiskey, and always blame the Canadians, and a 15-year-old passenger in the vehicle. Zamora was arrested and charged with DUI and possession of cocaine. Ha! And they say men never stop to ask for directions. Well, have you ever heard someone described as having a pole up their ass? Usually it means uptight, stuck up, or snobbish. But in this case, it just means the woman involved was a bad driver. And yes, she literally ended up with a pole stuck up her ass. The Colorado woman says she was texting and driving when she hit a pole that went through her car, piercing her thigh and buttocks. Firefighters had to saw off the front and back end of the pole to get the woman out. Christina Jans says she was in the parking lot of Elizabeth Middle School to deliver her daughter's saxophone, which had been left at home. As she was driving away from the school, Jans started texting her friend. "I was running late for a business meeting, so I did a voice text. I looked down to make sure it was all right. The next thing I knew, I was looking up, and there was white powder from the airbags deployed," Jans said. Then Jans realized that the guardrail pole went through the front of her truck, through her buttocks, and into the back of her seat. Wow. Firefighters used a saw to cut the front and back end of the pole before rushing her to the hospital. Said Jans, "I went into surgery and lost count of the stitches after 40. They stitched me up inside, too. I'm truly a miracle. They said if it had gone just a little bit the other way, I would have bled out." Jans was released after a 4-day stay in the hospital. She is expected to make a full recovery. Jan says even though she was going 20 miles an hour and looked down for only a split second, she has learned a lesson she will never forget. Yeah, I guess the lesson is she won't touch her phone in the car with a 10-foot pole. 37-year-old Ryan Centel State has been arrested in Salt Lake City after police said he admitted using mice and hamsters to get free hotel rooms. On January 30th, authorities alleged State would release the rodents in a hotel room, then complain about them, prompting hotel workers to offer the room for free. State faces charges of theft by deception and criminal mischief. Ah, the best laid schemes of mice and men. You know, every so often we come up with stories where people truly live up to their names. Case in point, a former employee of a finance firm is behind bars in Macon County, Tennessee, after allegedly stealing $51,000 in customer loan payments. 41-year-old Serena Swindle, yes, you heard right, Serena Swindle, was arrested on February 5th after a year-long investigation by the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation. Ms. Swindle was held on $3,500 bond at the Macon County Jail. Well, she better hope she's not sharing a cell with either Ms. Shanks or Ms. Slaughter. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a randy man from New Mexico allegedly tried to use a hamburger as currency to hire a prostitute. Unfortunately for him, the woman he was allegedly trying to solicit with the fast food item was an undercover cop. 36-year-old Dominic Calderon, a registered sex offender, was reportedly riding his bicycle down a street in Albuquerque on January 28th when he approached the undercover cop and asked her how much sex would cost. When the issue of payment arose, Calderon allegedly told the cop he couldn't pay because he wasn't going to get his paycheck until Friday. The man then reportedly asked the woman's phone number so he could inquire about services later. The cop then noticed Calderon was carrying a bag from a fast food joint.
"Where'd you get them? McDonald's, Wendy's, Jack in the Box, where?"
They came from Chili's.
"I hear they got some tasty burgers. I ain't never had one myself."
She then told Calderon that she could be paid with hamburger instead.
"Hamburgers!"
Calderon agreed.
"You mind if I try one of yours?"
And was then promptly arrested. He was charged with patronizing a prostitute. The burger was seized by cops and placed into evidence.
"This is a tasty burger."
I don't know. Doesn't this sound a bit like coercion or entrapment? And all of this for a Chili's hamburger?
Chili's is back, baby, back, baby, back. Mm-hmm. Or take your burgers to go, baby, go, baby, go.
Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? This year marks the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II and the liberation of Auschwitz. Stan Goldman is the author of a book that shares his mother's survival from two death camps and how his mother's release led directly to Adolf Hitler's suicide. The book is called Left to the Mercy of a Rude Stream, and Stan joins us on the line from California. Hi, Stan.
Hi, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. I mentioned in the introduction how your mother's release led directly to Adolf Hitler's suicide. It's a rather bold statement that I saw in your press release. What exactly does that mean?
Well, it's a little complicated, and I didn't discover it till some years after my mother died. But my mother, who to describe the anniversary of Auschwitz, by the way, did survive Auschwitz. She was actually sort of leading up to the Hitler issue. She was actually in the death line. She was waiting to be executed, and she was, according to the memoirs, her description of me and memoirs of some women who were with her, they were right at the front of the line, and then all of a sudden the line gets cut off. Instead of being put in the gas chamber, they're given some clothes, and they're put on a train, and they ride for 3 days and three nights, and they're not given any water, any food, and all of a sudden the door opens up to the train. It stops, it opens up, and they're in Berlin. They needed slave labor to work in a factory in Berlin. So my mother spent much of the latter part of the war being, bombed by the Allies in a Berlin factory working. And at the end, she gets shipped for execution to the place, one of the places that basically replaced Auschwitz. They didn't stop with gas chambers when Auschwitz closed. They sent Jews to other places, and they opened a gas chamber at a women's camp, a camp exclusively for women prisoners in Germany, called Ravensbrück. And my mother's in Ravensbrück, and probably about to be killed along with the others. And all of a sudden, one day out of nowhere, some buses arrive and mysteriously take her after a somewhat hazardous 4-day journey when she's being bombed by the Allies again, who think they're German trucks. They land in they arrive in Sweden. So this is how my mother was saved. But she never knew, she never actually knew what the buses were doing there, how they got there, why she gets released, while the war is still going on from another death camp. And the answer was actually a very strange thing that I only discovered some years after she passed away, and that was that there was this fellow, a Jewish businessman in Sweden, who had really grandiose ideas about trying to save Jews, and he wanted to meet with Himmler himself, the guy in charge of the Holocaust, the man second in charge of Germany, and he arranges through his connections and his wealth to actually get connected to an assistant of Himmler's, who then persuades Himmler to meet with this Jewish guy, and Himmler agrees to do it so long as they meet, just outside Berlin secretly, because he doesn't want Hitler to find out that he's talking to a Jew. And the afternoon he's going to get on a plane to leave, this Jewish guy's wife says to him, this businessman, if you go, I've lost all my other relatives, you have three small children, this is suicide. If you go, I swear to you, I will kill myself. And he believes her. But the plane's on the tarmac. It's got this swastika on it in Stockholm. It's going to take him directly to see Himmler. He's worked on this. So he turns to one of the businessmen in the group, one of these other Jewish guys who was with him there just to wish him well, and says, you speak German fluently, points at one of them. It has to be you. You have to go. So 2 hours later, out of nowhere, this guy quite unexpectedly has said, okay, gets on the plane, flies into Berlin, gets off the plane in Berlin, is greeted by six fully uniformed, dressed SS officers who signal Sieg Heil to this little Jewish businessman, who responds by taking his hat off and saying, well, good evening. And he gets taken through this harrowing trip to meet with Himmler. And it turns out Himmler was such a Nazi, was so involved in the Nazi propaganda, he really thought the Jews, he really did think Jews ran the world. He did think they really ran the world. So all he had to do was meet with some Jewish businessman, and it was a connection to the people that ran the world. So he basically says to this little Jewish guy, who's a furrier, by the way, look, if I could get a ceasefire on the Western Front, a promise, I would be prepared to a ceasefire, and I want you to speak to Churchill and Eisenhower about this. And instead of saying, look, I'm a furrier, you want a pair of nice mink gloves for your wife for her birthday? That's who you talk to. But what do I know from Eisenhower? Instead he says, sure, no problem. But, you know, there's this camp I just passed. Literally passes it on the way down to meet Himmler. It's about 60 kilometers from Germany. There's some Jewish women in there. We hear they're still being killed. I want some released, and I want them released right now. I want the order given to release them before I leave. And in exchange, I'll do this for you, which is, of course, a bluff. It's a total bluff. It's like a bluff of the century. And Himmler goes, yeah, okay, but don't tell anybody. We'll call them Polish women. We won't call them Jews. So Hitler doesn't find out, because, boy, am I going to be in trouble if Hitler finds out I'm releasing Jews. And that's how my mother gets out. And when Hitler does learn about it, which he does, because the Jewish guy, in fact, with some other connections, actually word was sent to the Allies of Himmler's interest. The Allies reject it and, in fact, tell the press. And Hitler's in the bunker, and I have the memoirs of people who were there with him. And Hitler's in the bunker, and he hears Goebbels comes to him with the news that he just read on Reuters that Himmler has been trying to negotiate a separate peace. And the word of the people who were there in the bunker with Hitler was it just was the end for him. His literally one phrase was his world had ended. His most loyal second in command was now betraying him by trying to set up a peace with the West apart from him. And it was early in the morning, past midnight. Hitler sits down. He writes what he calls his testament. He blames Himmler and Goebbels a bit for the loss of the war and sends it out with four messengers so it'll survive. And the next day, he kills himself.
Wow.
And historians agree that it was the Russians entering the city plus the discovery of Himmler's betrayal that caused his death, when and how it happened.
Now, your book is called Left to the Mercy of a Rude Stream. What exactly does that title mean?
Well, it's a paraphrase from Shakespeare's probably last play, Henry VIII. It is, my mother was, sort of caught in the, as all with her, were caught in the currents of history. I mean, that's what the phrase is intended to mean. The rude stream is the harsh, the harsh tidal wave of history that brings along sort of everyone who gets caught in it. My mother was caught in the worst of it. And it also has a double meaning. It's spoken by a character in the play, and it deals with his unawareness of the currents of history that he was caught in until it was too late. And now he can no longer escape them. And that has a double meaning in the book as well, because part of the book is talking about the effects the war had on my mother and the effect it had on those who knew her, especially, her son, me. It was something we sort of didn't quite realize until it was kind of too late to change her, and certainly also too late in many ways to change my course, because children of survivors like that, are never quite the same as everybody else. There's always just something about them, the guilt and the fear and the self-recrimination. You couldn't be there to help them, and the over-obsessive way in which you were raised by them, which was absolute fear. I mean, I could never really do anything as a child. I couldn't ride a bike. I couldn't have skates. There was terror that I would, be snatched or killed by somebody. Even though the Nazis were long defeated, something or someone or danger was always lurking. So that's in part what the book's about.
We're talking with Stan Goldman. He is the author of Left to the Mercy of a Rude Stream. here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. We'll take a quick break and we'll be right back.
You're listening to The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder. Facebook users, don't forget to join the Stuff File group. There's more Stuff File to come.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Informed or entertained? Hey, you're doing both. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And we're talking with Stan Goldman, who is the author of Left to the Mercy of a Rude Stream, a story that talks about his mother surviving not one but two death camps during World War II. And we spent the last little while telling the story about how she got away or how she escaped by evading the death camps and ending up in Sweden. But let's talk about your mother specifically. I know when we talk to people about the Holocaust, there's usually two groups of people. Those who never want to talk about it ever again and don't bring it up, and those who are willing to talk about it. Which group was your mother in?
My mother was in the group that never really wanted to talk about it. I mean, every once in a while, as she might have said in a blue moon, although it was far less common than a blue moon, something would come out. Some little story, some memory, some, you know, when I was a kid, for example, we could never have ice cream in the house, not because she was opposed to ice cream, but the freezer was always just full to capacity with bread and rolls, and we'd basically never eat them. They'd be there for a few months and they'd be frostbit, and she'd discard them and replace them with others. And finally, one day as a kid, I turned to her and said, "Mom, you know, why can't we have some ice cream in the house? Why do we always have all this bread in the freezer?" And she paused and said, and she had a very thick accent, by the way. I'll do her now. When I was in the war and I was starving, I swore to myself, if I got through this, I would always have bread. And then she sort of just sat there for a few minutes, and I didn't say anything. And then she got up and she took all the bread out of the freezer and she dumped it in the trash, and she never froze bread again. And as I say in the book, I guess I maybe did her a favor, her phobia exposed. She got rid of the bread. But if that's true, if I did her a favor, how come all these decades later I still feel guilty about having asked? So yeah, that was the only time something would come up. She would, you know, if something would come up, and then she'd get a little, you know, dazed look in her eye, and then she'd say something about it. But it was only near the end, when she was basically in her last few years of life, and she'd had a stroke, but her mind was still fine. She started talking about it, which happens to some survivors. They get to be older, and she's quite old, and they'll start to tell the stories.
So
in fact, I couldn't have done the research for my book if I. It, 20 years ago, there wasn't enough information, there weren't enough memoirs, there weren't enough, you know, things for me to base my book on.
So even if she was someone who didn't want to talk about it, generally speaking, would she open up at least a little bit if she ever came into contact with other Holocaust survivors, or was it just an off-topic situation regardless of who she was speaking to?
Well, if she was, she never spoke to me, and my father as well, they never spoke to me except in English. But when their friends would come over, and I grew up in a milieu of many Holocaust survivors, because that's who her friends were. They were other Polish Jews, for the most part, who had survived and created a little community here in Los Angeles. They would occasionally, you'd hear something. I'd pick up something, a line here or there. It was not a topic of discussion. It would be kind of like something would get said, and somebody would say, you know, a four-word sentence, and people would nod, and then they'd move on. Survivors to survive have to be more than just survivors. You have to have your you know, you have to sort of go on living. And they all of them became very obsessive about their next generation, you know, accumulating as much as they could, making sure their kids did their homework. And, you know, and it was, you know, that they wanted to forget, but it was not possible.
Looking back at your mother's life, looking back in hindsight, you know, the bread story aside in the freezer, do you feel she was able to eclipse the shadow of what she went through in the Holocaust, or was it always with her, weighing her down?
I think it was always with her, but people, you know, go on. I mean, there's a Isaac Bashevis Singer was a Nobel-winning writer who's got a story he wrote called The Cafeteria, in which it's basically autobiographical. He's talking about himself sitting in a cafeteria in New York, and he's surrounded by a bunch of guys. This is in the 50s, a bunch of guys who were Holocaust survivors, and he describes it as such. He says, you know, we sit there and we talk about politics and the Holocaust, and we talk about Israel, and we talk about those who are, you know, we knew who are no longer here, of course, and then we pause. And it reminds me, says Isaac Singer, of a movie he saw about Africa and the Serengeti Plains, where these antelope are just grazing nicely, and then all of a sudden a lion jumps out and kills one of them. The whole herd starts to run and run and run, and after a while they get hungry and they stop and they start to graze again. I mean, he doesn't even give an explanation as to what he means by the story in the book, but it's pretty clear. There's a choice at some point in life. Either you go on living or you don't. And even though something may be weighing you down in the back of your mind and never able to overcome it entirely, you made a decision to go on living. My mother was apparently, I mean, I interviewed women who were with my mother. They said she was all 4'10" of her. They said, you know, if one of them fell down, and there were moments when these women, one would fall down, and she'd say, I'm not getting up, I'm done, I can't take this anymore. They describe an incident in which my mother grabbed one of them by the hair and lifted her up by the hair, hurting her, and said, you are not going to lay down and die. You know, you're not going to give the Nazis the satisfaction of dying. You're going to stand up and we're going to get through this. You know, so you know, that's what it took to get through this. It took a lot of internal strength, and even the ability to go on living, which may have taken more strength than anything else.
The anniversary of World War II and the anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz is this year. That's 75 years ago. However, there is that old axiom that those who don't remember history are doomed to repeat it. And we keep seeing signs globally of racial strife and strain. Are you concerned about what's happening in the world today? And do you see things as signs that maybe other people don't pay attention to because other people don't have the historical background that some of the Jews have and have learned to deal with over the years?
Look, I would be fooling you if I didn't say that I see the signs all over today. I didn't see the signs nearly as much 20 years ago, but in the last few years, there's no question that that hatred of the other has sort of been validated again. I mean, there was a period of time after the Holocaust, maybe people don't realize it, in which because of it, certain subjects were almost verboten. Politicians would be cursed for you know, or basically lose election, or be, you know, if they went too far in hatreds of other groups, it was just unacceptable. Certainly anti-Semitism, but it's been given license to open again, and it turns out that even science, which has greatly improved in terms of analyzing the brain and how we think and how we're created, is telling us that it is a very short step between hating a group of other people and being prepared to do something really, really bad, because hatred and fear triggers some sort of, you know, I'll use the generic term, prehistoric, you know, genetic thing in us to only protect our family. And our family is described very broadly. You know, people we have we have similarities with, and what's that? There's a line of Voltaire: anyone who can persuade you to believe absurdities can persuade you to commit atrocities. I fear that's what's going on in the world today. I mean, I didn't start my book at a time. I started my book 10 years ago, 12 years ago, but, you know, and worked on it for a number of years, but I think it, unfortunately, is far more relevant today than it was when I started.
Was your mother still alive when you started the book?
No, I didn't discover the connection between my mother and the Himmler exchange and how she was actually rescued till 7 years after she passed away. She had no idea, and I kind of just stumbled across it. The fellow who negotiated her release wrote a short memo, kind of a letter to the World Jewish Congress back at the time, this charitable organization, just to let them know what he had done in meeting with Himmler and getting these Jews released from this camp. And I happened to come across it, you know, and I said, man, this sounds just like the way my mother was freed. The dates work out. And then I went researching it, and sure enough, it was the incident. And only then, after about a year, I said, yeah, I should write a little article about this. And I did. And then Holocaust scholar contacted me and said, you know, you really should turn this into a book. And I said, nah. And about a year later, I had some time, and I sat down and thought it'd take me 8 months to write. It took me eight more years to do the research as meticulously as I think it demanded because of Holocaust deniers. You know, if you leave anything for chance, they'll claim it's not true. And also just rewriting it because it's a nonfiction, although I pride myself on the fact that the reviewers have said it reads like a novel. And I wrote it and rewrote it so that it read exactly like that, but it's completely true.
What do you think your mother would say about the book?
About this, my book?
Yes.
Think she'd, I actually mention in my book what I think she'd say. You know, I sort of envisioned her at one point, you know, as I'm right in the middle of writing the book. I think she'd turn to me and say, Stanley, it's too much trouble. You should stop before you get too tired or upset. I mean, I can just hear her saying that. I think she would have, but when it was done, I think she would have been very, very, very pleased. I think she would have been happy that her story was told and that it was her son who was telling it. But as I said, it's a story I didn't just tell because it was my mother. I wouldn't have given up. You know, I'm a college professor. I wouldn't have given up everything else I write for years just to do this book if I didn't think it was a story that had to be told.
It's a story that has to be told, but who do you see as being your audience when you were starting to write this book? Who were you trying to reach?
In all honesty, I was trying to teach younger people. I saw the book and I wrote it I'm a law professor, but I also used to write for the New York Daily News for a couple of years. I was a reporter with them. So I know how to write, you know, to different audiences. And I wrote this hoping that it would be read by 17-year-olds and 18-year-olds in high school or undergraduates. And sure enough, the book was assigned by one college, one university, and one English professor read the book and assigned it, believe it or not, in a literature class. It wasn't even a history class. It was a literature class. They liked the way I wrote the book. But for the most part, the readership seems to be from the word I've gotten, basically septuagenarians who can kind of identify with it, even though I wrote the book for teenagers. And I'm hoping it someday finds an audience with teenagers what I did was the book, if you don't include the endnotes, it's 42 pages of endnotes of all the research, but it's 150 short pages. And what I do in the book is I put my mother's story into the context of the Holocaust. I mean, one professional reviewer, you know, for a journal said that if you only have time to read one book about the Holocaust, make it this one, because I do cover the entire Holocaust from beginning to end, because that's what my mother went through. She went through the ghettos, as they call it, and then the camps, and then the slave labor, and then I talk about after the war, you know, the psychological impact, and also the battle for reparations, and the battle for justice at Nuremberg, and all of these make an appearance in my book as described, because all of that was part of my mother's story.
Well, it's a story that not only needs to be heard or read rather by septuagenarians, but the young Jews and non-Jews. So it's an interesting story and one that should be told. The book is called Left to the Mercy of a Rude Stream. It's written by Stan Goldman. And Stan, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
And the book can be acquired just under my name on Amazon. I think Stan Goldman's probably easier to remember than the title.
Thank you very much, Stan.
Thank you.
Stan Goldman, author of Left to the Mercy of a Rude Stream. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0548, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's now gluten-free.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to the author of Chin Up, Tits Out. Plus, we do indeed have more Stuff File news to share with you, and also an idiot of the day coming your way here on The Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn and via Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Just click on the Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify buttons located on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, Giovanni Palmiero, who is 101, has been living in the United Kingdom since 1966, so logically, he applied to remain there after Brexit. Alarmingly, the Home Office demanded that Giovanni's parents confirm his identity and accompany him to an office in North London to make his application. Dimitri Scarlato, a volunteer helping Giovanni, immediately realized the computer had read his birth year as 2019 instead of as 1919. I phoned the Home Office and it took two calls and a half an hour for them to understand, Scarlato said. Giovanni has been married to his 92-year-old wife, Lucia, for 75 years. Wait a minute, he's 101, she's 92? What a cradle robber. They will be able to remain in the UK. Okay, once you get past the obvious bureaucratic bungling of this story, there is one question to be asked. Giovanni has been in the country for over 50 years. Don't you think that perhaps it's time to consider getting citizenship? Yeah. A Michigan man has been charged for allegedly driving drunk to his court hearing with a blood alcohol level nearly four times the legal limit. 57-year-old James Gerd was in court for a hearing on an operating while intoxicated charge that he received on December 30th. The judge noticed concerning behavior by Gerd and requested testing. Gerd had difficulty speaking without slurring his words, according to the prosecutor's office. He allegedly told officers he had a couple of shots. They also found a partly emptied bottle of vodka in his car. He was arraigned on a charge of operating a vehicle while intoxicated with a high blood alcohol content, a 180-day misdemeanor. A magistrate ordered Gerd held on a $2,500 bond and scheduled his next court appearance for March the 5th. Who knows? He may be sober by then. Now, you're probably thinking that going before a judge while drunk, while fighting a drunk driving charge, is probably one of the dumbest situations you can find yourself in as an impaired driver. Oh, but wait. I think this next story gives it a run for its money. Call it a lesson neither the student nor the teacher will forget. Coquitlam, BC RCMP says it recently busted a student driver mid-driving lesson for impaired driving. Said Corporal Michael McLaughlin, "It's not often you tow a car with two steering wheels, but impaired is impaired. Everyone must be safe on the road." It happened on February 2nd when an officer saw the car with a large student driver sign on the back run a stop sign. The officer pulled the car over and administered a roadside sobriety test. The 44-year-old student driver failed. The driving instructor, operating for a small Richmond company, had his car impounded for 30 days. Investigators told both the driver and the driving school could subsequently face a review. "This may be a funny story, but we're serious about keeping our community safe," said McLaughlin. You know, I'm guessing bad Yelp reviews are the least of that driving school's problems. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our last guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, speeding with your wife, infant, and hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of cocaine in your car is a great idea if you want to attract the attention of law enforcement, which is exactly what happened in this case. A man driving 85 miles an hour as he careened among cars and lanes during a rush hour on Interstate 5 in Southern California, his wife and infant son in tow, was arrested after U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents discovered more than 50 pounds of cocaine in the vehicle. The agents pulled over the 34-year-old U.S. citizen, who they did not identify publicly, when they saw him driving erratically between lanes and around drivers. He was in a 2012 Nissan Altima. Police followed the driver to San Clemente, a coastal city about halfway between San Diego and Los Angeles. You remember San Clemente, home of Richard Nixon? Yeah. Anyway, he continued driving frantically during that whole stretch. He then pulled into a shopping center parking lot where he and his wife jumped out of the car and walked away at a fast clip. Agents approached the couple and asked for consent to search their vehicle. The man agreed, and agents discovered a duffel bag in the car trunk that contained 20 brick-shaped packages of cocaine. Agents also discovered an additional package of cocaine tucked inside a shopping bag near the infant's car seat. In total, there were 21 bundles of cocaine weighing 51.25 pounds with an estimated street value of $512,500. While this was happening, the woman said she needed a restroom and walked into the shopping center with the baby. She never came back. Agents later located them a quarter mile away. All three individuals were taken to a nearby Border Patrol station for further investigation. Both the man and his drugs were handed over to the Orange County Drug Enforcement Administration office, and he was arrested. The mother and infant were released. The vehicle was seized by the U.S. Border Patrol. Remember back in the so-called saner days when people hauling the most illegal of contraband in their vehicles were most likely to be the safest drivers because they were afraid of getting caught? You know, back then, if you saw someone driving slowly and using their turn signals, they were either a World War II vet who was in his 80s or a drug mule. Memories. Anyway, let's get to our last guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Author Miranda Oh is releasing the third and final chapter of her romantic chick lit series, Chin Up, Tits Out. It continues the saga of Hadley, who is recently divorced and is rapidly approaching her 30th birthday as a single woman. Miranda joins us via Skype from Winnipeg. Hi, Miranda.
Hey, Peter. Hey, everybody.
Thanks for being on the program with us.
Thanks for having me.
The title of your book, the title of your series, Chin Up, Tits Out, that sounds like a very mean high school girls' gym teacher.
Oh my goodness, that's so funny you should say that, because you know what it stemmed from? I'm going to tell you because you probably want to know, so I'm going to tell you. So it came from my mom when I was in high school, and I was giving her some kind of like attitude, some sauciness, and I was like, Mom, do I look good? And like, I knew I looked good, but I wanted somebody to tell me that I looked good. And she was like, oh, just chin up, tits out, go have fun, like, don't give me this. And I was like, and she's like, you know, you're good looking. I'm like, oh, thanks, Mom. But let's rewind like 15 years, and I'm a child, an infant. And it was my mom and I had this kind of daily routine where we would stand up straight and strike a pose and tell each other that we're beautiful. And then as we got older and, you know, experience new things and, you know, get stressed or get into a situation where you're not really confident, it was, you know, hold your chin up high, shoulders back, stand up tall, stand up straight, just those little coaching tools to our physical body that made us feel more confident in time, but also it made us look more confident outwards. And it's kind of like that fake it till you make it, but I grew up with chin up, tits out.
Now, they always say, write what you know. I just gave a bit of the synopsis of your book in the introduction. Who is Hadley, and how close is she to you?
Cool. She's like the more refined version of me, simply because I can edit and delete and reword and revise and then pay somebody to edit that. I did write a lot about what I experienced throughout my 20s and others in my life, whether they were family or friends or partners or this or that. And then I slapped fiction on it and said, hey, This is a series about a completely random group of people that don't exist, and our characters are a compilation of real people, but then again, refined, going, how do I make this character in this book either more relatable or better or worse, depending on what I wanted that, you know, the purpose of that character was in the book.
As I mentioned, this is the third and final chapter of your romantic series. When you first started writing, did you ever envision the idea, the success you would have, the fact that you would have a trilogy?
No. I had way too much time on my hands. I was used to working 60, 70 hours a week, and then I got one job that was 9 to 5, and I was like, oh my goodness, all that life experience came rushing back to me. So it was like, girl, you're going to write a book. And then I wrote a third of it, and it was like 30,000 words, and my publisher was like, no, you need to like rethink this whole one book thing. And I'm a big believer in like all good things come in threes, so I was like, why not a trilogy? So it just randomly popped up that way, and I kind of stumble upon things all the time, and it's always positive. I'm just grateful for where I am right now.
So again, when you're writing, it's a very solitary kind of situation. You're inside your own head. When you finally finish this and you hand it off to your editors, you hand it off to your publisher, when was the moment that you realized that you had something here, something that was potentially successful?
You know what? Honestly, I don't think it happens until I have the actual book in my hands. And then when I have the book in my hand, I like cry happy tears. I'm like, okay, now I got to celebrate this with everybody that means something to me. So I have a book launch party at the end of the month. And I think once that is out, then I'm more so at a point where I'm like, this is real now. All of the stuff beforehand is just like this wild air balloon ride. And I'm just happy. So I'm going with it.
Yeah, but the reason why I bring that up is you've had some very good reviews. I mean, that's got to be heady stuff when you see the your work coming back at you in such glowing ways from other people.
It's mind blowing, actually. Every time I get a review and it's positive, it strikes me as if it was the first positive review that I ever got. And that's the same if I get a negative review. It's like, oh, it's a stab to the heart. But either way, my heart is is getting a lot of action when it comes to these reviews. I had no idea that it was going to be that way. I had so much fun writing them, and I have so much fun sharing them. So I guess it's just a ripple effect, maybe. I'm not sure.
Now, you know, in mainstream media, you've done a lot of reviews, you've done interviews. Have you had any pushback on just the title?
Oh, yeah. I giggle because it's oh my God, it's so offensive. And I'm like, or it's so, like naughty. And I'm like, no, actually, in fact, it means it's confidence and it's inner confidence. It's like power posing, but with a little bit of sass to it. I'm a fiction book, so I have to catch people's eyes, and throwing tits on the title catches people's eyes. And then when you kind of look at the balloons, you're like, oh, well, it can't be that provocative. You know, and it can't be so... All I wanted to do was kind of evoke some sort of curiosity within the title, and I caught it, I hope, and then evoke emotion within the writing.
I know I kind of asked this question already, but is your lead character, is Hadley the girl you were or the girl you want to be?
I think every single book she evolves as I do. I think the first book is very much the girl that I was. Second book is the girl that Hadley was, and then, or sorry, that I was, and then the third book really comes to play as, you know, who I'm striving to be and the things that I've learned over the decade and how I'm putting that into practice in my day-to-day life. Like, yeah, sure, chin up, tits out, yay. But it's like, how do you actually put that into practice to see a difference in your life? And you know, that comes across all the troubles and issues we see across the series. And the third book is really how you're striving to get that.
Now, I did mention in the introduction the term chick lit, but have you heard from guys who have read your stuff?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I have males from about 18 to 80 across multiple religions from across different countries. If they know me, they have no choice to buy a book from me. So I force it upon people, but I'm like, you want to get to know me? Read my books and then we can talk about it. I've had males read the books and they're like, oh my gosh, is that what happens in women's heads? I'm like, yes, it is. And it also happens in your head. Like, you do have an inner voice that kind of teases you or that coaches you on or that tells you what's good or tells you what's bad. Or, you know, like, we all have that inner voice, and that's, you know, another angle of being positive and having that positive inner voice. We've all got to embrace it. So I encourage men to read it, even though it has that chick lit stab.
Okay, so third time at the same kind of question. now that you've written the book and yes. or the series, the three books, and you've gotten all of this out of you, has writing down and sharing the story of Hadley changed you or your own perception of you?
Oh, yes. 100%. 150%, because you're sitting there, the first book, and you're like, man, I actually wrote a book. I'm so cool, you know? And then you look back at it 5 years later and you're like, girl, you had no idea what you were doing. And then you write book two and you're like, oh yeah, that's so cool. And then you read back and you're like, that was good, but look at this book three. And so it has definitely made me relook at who I am, relook at who I want to be. Am I on that path? Am I on the right trajectory? And if I'm not, what are those things that I got to work on? You know, what do I want and in the future, and how do I get there? So these books actually have helped me hold myself accountable in the things that I want to accomplish in my future.
So, speaking of your future, what's next for you?
Ooh, I am mapping out my next trilogy. Like I said, good things come in three. So I'm mapping out another trilogy. It's going to be chick lit. It's going to be fiction again. And it's going to be a compilation of real life stories told from women all around the world. So I'm really excited because I got to map out the interviews and the questions and my research process. And then I am going to dive right in there for about 6 months.
Do you get any kind of melancholy feeling, the fact that you're closing the book on Hadley, or will we hear from her in the future?
Ooh, you know, there is a little bit of like want to throw her into the next series, but I haven't decided. I think during my research phase, I'm really going to start to develop what my main characters are going to be in each of the next three books.
Well, the current series, which has just come to a final chapter, is called Chin Up, Tits Out. Miranda, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you, Peter, for having me. I'm very grateful.
Miranda Oh, author of the third and final chapter of her romantic chick lit series, Chin Up, Tits Out. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0548, and you'll find links to Miranda's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her books directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A man entered a Lafayette, Indiana convenience store, pulled a knife, and demanded money from the two clerks. The clerks simply closed the security enclosure they were in, and the man left without any money. Police were able to quickly identify 42-year-old Sean Yoakum and arrested him on charges of attempted robbery and resisting law enforcement. The reason for the quick capture? Yoakum was readily identified by one of the clerks. His brother. Now, why, oh why, would you try to pull an armed robbery at the very same convenience store that your brother works at? And if you were so determined to go down that road, why wouldn't you at least check first on when your brother was working so that you might be able to avoid when he was on shift for your crime? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0548. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0548. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on Patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. We leave you with this deep environmental thought. If we don't do something about global warming soon, eventually there won't be any ice floes left to put our elders on.